From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Guardian editor Gary Young reported from the United States for over a decade. Today on the show, we talk with him about his book, Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives.
One of the things that struck me writing this book was every single black parent that I spoke to thought this could happen to their child.
Then the new director of Madison's Chazen Museum says it's a constant effort to make sure everyone knows they're welcome, even if they've never been to an art museum before.
You can get people in with a specific program, but to get them to come back, you have to demonstrate that the invitation was not just for that, that you are actually programming by thinking about them.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Exfabula, and hear a new song from Milwaukee's Mike Mangione. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. The mass shooting that killed more than two dozen people at a church in rural Texas was one of the latest in a string of such shootings in this country. From Texas to Las Vegas to Charleston and Newtown, mass shootings shock and outrage Americans for various reasons.
But writer Gary Young says there's another trend that should be just as disturbing, the deaths of children from gun violence every day. Young is black, British, of Barbadian descent, and his wife is African American. He covered the U.S. for more than a decade for the Guardian newspaper, for which he is now editor-at-large back in Britain.
His recent book is called Another Day in the Death of America. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about it, and Young says the regularity of gun violence he sees in this country has always been difficult to explain elsewhere, but it was having two African American children that crystallized the need for him to tell the stories that he does in the book.
I think having two kids in America anyway, if you're not from America, would alert you. You know, the gun that washed up beside my son's school in Chicago. We lived in Chicago for 4 years. Or the shootout near his daycare. Those would have happened, whatever race we were. Being black just raised the odds. And, I mean, one of the things that struck me writing this book was every single black parent that I spoke to thought this could happen to their child. The mother in Dallas said, I didn't think it would be him, I thought it would be his brother. The father in Newark said, you're not doing your job as a black father if you don't think your child could be shot in Newark. So there is that extra burden because of those extra odds.
The other thing that struck me with this book is the way you decided to explore the topic. You picked a day and you tried to find everyone, every child, who had been shot that day. Why that particular structure?
I was keen, by picking a day and then allowing the day to choose the cases and therefore not gaming it, that if I'd picked a different day, I would have a different book. And I was actually particularly insistent, even though in some ways, as a reader, it would be easier if I didn't do this, that the children come in the order in which they're shot, which means the first chapter is in many ways the hardest. It's the youngest child, 9 years old. He answers the door, his mother's ex-partner shoots him in the head, and then runs away and is eventually shot in a shootout with the police. I would not have started with that chapter if I wanted to pace people's emotional kind of engagement with the book, but I was adamant not to game it. And so this is the day, this is how they fell, because to me the power and the conceit is, if this book takes you a week to finish, well, then there'll be pretty much 50 kids will be dead in that week. And this is just the day as I found it. And I took the day at random. People often want to know, you know, why that day? Why not another day? And it was the first day I could do, and it's a reliable statistic that 7 kids on average in America are shot dead every day. So you can pick a day, and as macabre as it sounds, you can pick a day and you can wait for the kids to die. They will die.
And so those stories are there. It just, whose stories it happens to be that day.
Well, that's it. The next thing about that conceit is really journalistic, that these are happening in plain sight every day. And we are taught, I was taught in journalism school, you know, dog bites man is not a story, man bites dog is a story. And there's a way in which these are dog bites man stories. And that sooner or later you have to ask yourself, who owns these dogs? And why do the same people keep being bitten? And what can we do to stop this happening? There is something about the way that these deaths happen here and the way in which the country has become inured to them, well, that just happens. And so long as they happen in a certain way, in certain places, to certain people, then it becomes the kind of white noise that everybody can be used to. Every now and then the country is kind of concretized by a mass shooting, but these do not make the headlines. And so that was the other journalistic kind of drive in this pursuit, was to tell stories that aren't told.
The media, as you say, in the country doesn't report these deaths. They happen so often. There might be one or two lines in a newspaper. What role does American journalism play in continuing this cycle?
Well, to be fair, you know, journalism can't be understood outside of the context of society. So there are things that are going on in Britain that are, you know, I wouldn't even know what they are because I'm British. It would take if you wanted to know what was going on in Ireland, you didn't read a British newspaper in the 60s. You would have read the Boston Globe or the New York Times or whatever they were, you know. There was some good reporting from Britain, but by and large, outsiders just will see things that you don't see. And it doesn't mean they're always right. It's not really about being right. It's just having a sort of different gaze. And so it's not just journalism. I think American society doesn't see these deaths. They are mostly poor. They are disproportionately black and brown. So they don't see these people. They don't see these lives. So why would they see these deaths? You know, when Katrina happened, and then suddenly all of these poverty and this, it was washed up, and people were kind of like, well, you know, where the hell did that come from? Or Black Lives Matter, that it's not that more people are being killed by the police, it's that we are now paying attention to something that's been going on for a while. And so it speaks to a broader problem of race and class. Now, these are problems that every society has. It's just that the one thing that no other Western society has is guns on this scale.
When you were doing the research to learn about the lives of these children who were killed, were people talking to you about Second Amendment? Because that comes up so much here, whether you are pro-gun or anti-gun or whatever it is in this. And there are a lot of people in this country who are very anti-gun and would like to see the kinds of restraints on them that you have in Britain, that you have in Canada, that you have in Australia. Mm. So were people talking about it in those ways?
It was one of the oddest things to me. It never came up. The Second Amendment never came up. Actually, guns barely came up. I would ask each family the open-ended question. 10 kids died that day, were shot dead that day, and I would speak to, I reached 8 kin, and I would ask them, well, what do you think this is about? Not a single one mentions guns. And I assume that it's a bit like traffic, that if your child was run over, you wouldn't think, well, we must get rid of traffic because it's difficult to imagine a world without traffic and it's not going anywhere, so why waste your emotional energy on something that's not going to happen? so it doesn't come up. When I ask a more leading question, what do you think of guns, then people generally would say, well, I think it's crazy, you know, there's too many of them around, it's too easy. They would evoke the ancient art of pugilism, you know, in my day we would settle them with our fists and so on. But with the open-ended question, no, it doesn't come up. I get that, actually. I do get that. And particularly with the Second Amendment, when I was promoting the book last year, quite often the Second Amendment would come up in radio call-ins. And I would emphasize, look, this is not a book about gun control. It's just a book that is made possible by the lack of gun control. So I'm not going to argue with you about scripture, which is essentially what the Second Amendment is. You just have to talk to me about how we keep these kids alive and how I keep my kids alive in a country where 7 children are shot dead every day. Or do you love that amendment more than you love your kids?
And what would they say?
A range of things, few of which to me were plausible. Well, there were arguments which I disagree with, but I think, you know, I can engage with, you know, it's about parenting, it's not about guns, it's you know, lack of morality and all. And to that I would always say, I don't think that American parents are worse than parents anywhere else in the Western world. I don't think American kids are worse than anywhere else in the Western world, so it's got to be something else. One gentleman said, well, look, if you took a few cities out of the country, then this number goes way down. And I said, well, if you took Chicago and New Orleans and Newark and if you took those out of the country, but then where are you going to get your jazz from? Where are you going to get your blues from? Where, you know, where are you going to get a range of things that make America what it is? And so people kind of actively try and imagine America without these people and the places that they live. And in a sense, that's the kind of heartbreaking thing, the degree to which people will seek to dismiss these deaths as being the function of some kind of death wish culture, which I just don't think it is. I think Americans like life as much as anybody else anywhere else in the world.
You wrote in here that you felt like you had to scream every day that you were working on this book. Was it worth it?
It was definitely worth it for me. It was the last thing I did. I reported from America for 12 years, and this was the end of this time. I learned a huge amount about the country doing this, and you can get quite jaded, particularly on something like this, where there would be a mass shooting, and I would be called, Gary, there's been a mass shooting, go to Virginia, Aurora, Red Lake, Minnesota, you know, I mean, and you run out of adjectives, you run out of metaphors, and, you know, after a while, you're like, what do you want me to do? And so to kind of deep dive in the way that I did, and to struggle with some of the explanations, and to think, well, where's that coming from? What does that mean? What, you know, to kind of terms that I have used often, like gang related, and then to kind of see the lives of these kids and think, well, that's not actually telling you very much. If you grew up in that block or that project, whatever, then everybody in that project is gang related. I mean, just by fact that you live there, and it's no more meaningful than saying, well, he was a communist, and because, you know, if they live in China, when you're surrounded in the way that you are, in a gang controlled area, then you have a relationship to that gang, even if that relationship is that you're not in it. I discovered that black fathers are more likely to bathe their children, change their children, read to them, put them to bed, than any other race of father. And I thought, well, that can't be true, because I thought I knew. And then you think, well, hang on, you do those things. You know, and I married an American, as I said, I have American kids. I thought I knew the country, and in a range of ways, this book showed me how much more there was to know and how some of the things I knew were far more interesting than I ever realized.
Do you feel like you have come to different conclusions?
I have a bit. I mean, I do think that my relationship to the gun control issue has become more complicated insofar as anything that they could do to reduce the number of guns in society would be a good thing, I believe. If guns, more guns make you safer, then America should be the safest place on earth, and it's not. But I did, by the end, think it's more than that, that America needs a different story for itself that isn't about conquering and domination and masculinity and homestead and small government and rugged individualism, because all of those lead to the gun. And America's not alone in having those. Britain is in the process, thanks to Brexit, of finding out how small it is as a country. It's a long time coming, and it's an unfortunate way to find out. But that being small, but having an empire, and then being in the European Union and having a special relationship with America and all of those things have given Britons a kind of different sense of who they are, somewhat puffed up. Well, now we are finding out how small we are. Every country has its own myths, and some of those myths are deadly, and this is one of them, I think. So it changed my thinking about that, and it gave me some sense, therefore, of why, whatever the next one will be, why nothing will happen, because those myths will endure long after the pictures of the grieving people have gone. The other thing I would say, this is less, you know, pleasant, was the degree to which people really, in order to dismiss these deaths, or in the process of dismissing these deaths, actually strip the dead of their humanity. When I started, I thought, well, obviously segregation is a barrier to empathy. You know, well, I don't know those people, so kind of there's less reason why I should care. That's normal. But by the end of it, I thought that some people thought this wasn't just happening to people unlike them, but it was actually not happening to people at all, but to a different kind of species. And that species was one where parents didn't love their children and children didn't love life, and where parents were negligent and children were feral. And so everybody was working on a different kind of premise in which the value of life was diminished, which is just simply not true. I mean, my experience of meeting the families and talking to them, it's not true. They knew their kids, they loved their kids, they wanted their kids to live, and one of the things that hurts is the notion that their child was removed from the planet, and it didn't seem to challenge anything about how America thinks about itself. If anything, it just confirmed it.
Nothing changed, including attitudes.
Right. Nothing changed, and kind of worse than that, in a sense, when people heard, oh yes, in Pleasant Grove, Dallas, or in this, they thought, well, that's what happens down there. So it actually confirms what they thought. In 2002, I interviewed Maya Angelou, and she, referring to 9/11, she said, well, everybody was shocked, everybody was stunned, but African Americans have been living in a state of terror in this country for several hundred years. And so the idea that something like this might happen, not this in particular, but something so, is not so counter to, you know, what we've experienced. And I thought it was interesting, and I put it in my piece, but I didn't really understand it until I'd written this book and realized and empathized as a parent with the idea that these parents are walking around not worrying, will my kid go to college? I hope he or she meets someone nice. You know, what will they wear to graduation? But will my child stay alive? Will my child stay alive?
Do you have any hope that it will change? I mean, like you say, you have American kids. Your wife is American. I assume even though you're back in Britain, you'll be visiting family and that sort of thing. I mean, do you hope things change? And if so, how do you see it changing?
I don't see the roadmap particularly. I say in Britain when, because nobody else gets this, so you know, the book's been translated into French and Dutch, and so I've done events elsewhere, and people say, well, do you think they can change? And I say that with my tongue half in my cheek, they elected Barack Obama, and then they elected Donald Trump, and that means they can do anything that they put their mind to. For a country that has done so many things, one must believe that they could do this. So, yeah, I think it's possible.
Do you think it's probable?
No, I don't. But an awful lot can change in a place in a quite quick period of time. Americans aren't any dafter than anyone else in the world. If everybody else can get it, Americans can't get it. The question is, what will it take? And the reason why I don't think it's probable is if Sandy Hook didn't do it, then one wonders what event, you know, will do it. And also, if we look at, I don't know, what's going on with Harvey Weinstein and all of the stuff, that suddenly things unravel, and things unravel at such a pace and in such a way that kind of within months, one can move what should have taken years, can move in months.
So we can hope.
There's always hope.
Well, Gary Young, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Young is the editor-at-large for Britain's The Guardian, and he's author of Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives. He was in Milwaukee last month to speak at Cardinal Stritch University, and we spoke with him then.
We'll take a short break and then return with the next episode in our Radio Chipstone series, where we meet the new director of the Chazen Art Museum in Madison. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Back in September of this year, Dr. Amy Gilman said goodbye to the Toledo Museum of Art and hello to her new position as the director of the Chazen Museum in Madison. While taking on the direction of a major museum can be daunting, you would never know it by Gilman's attitude. In fact, she says that it's everything you want a new challenge to be.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Fields meets Dr. Gilman in a place that she finds both inspiration and comfort.
We are on the bridge of the museum. Inside, we are straddling the original Elvium building, which was finished in 1970, and the new Chazen building, which was just completed a number of years ago. One of the reasons why I chose this spot is because it is the spot that I return to when I need to think about where we started, right, where the museum started, where we are now, right? The original building, the new building, the link between the two things, and the fact that we are standing on what is now one of the main gateways to the campus. So the museum is both of the campus and of the community, right? So we need to be able to face the university and we need to be able to face the community. And the museum is a great bridge. Yeah, we are physically a bridge here, but it is also that that there's a metaphor there for what museums are supposed to be doing, which is connecting to audience and community, and not just visitors, but you know, people near and far, to have a discussion about not just about art, but about things that are going on, and museums can have a rich part of that dialogue.
Amy, how do you invite people who don't necessarily feel like they're in on the conversation into the museum?
You actually have to invite people into the building. We just think that because we are free and because we do all of this programming, that my gosh, who wouldn't come, right? And that is such a passive way of thinking about what we do, right? Is that if we just put out a little sign that people will know where the door is and that they will come in and that they will then know how to get around, right? Whereas in reality, there are people who have not grown up coming to museums, who do not feel like they belong in these spaces. So what do you do to get them in and to get them to come back, right? Because you can get people in with a specific program. But to get them to come back, you have to demonstrate that the invitation was not just for that, that you are actually programming by thinking about them. Also, you need to come up with vehicles to make sure that they feel that this space is also their space. You need to figure out how to be relevant to what people are interested in today. It's not about saying, oh, we're going to do this program because this kind of thing is hot right now. It's actually about saying, what are the things that people are interested in thinking about? What are they doing right now? And how are museums going to be a part of that dialogue? Because people will come for things that are so far outside of their normal interest if you give them a reason to do it. So really, it's a multifaceted approach, but it is about thinking about the museum as this space in which you can explore all of those things. But you can't just do that with your traditional audience. You don't want to lose your traditional audience, but if we want to acknowledge the kind of diversity of community in which we are trying to live within, you have to be relevant to a broader spectrum of people than those who have already self-selected that they're comfortable and that they will come back here.
So, Amy, how do you figure out all these big questions, all these big challenges and opportunities, as we like to say, so it doesn't sound so daunting, when you've been here 2 months?
I am coming in at a moment of great change for the institution. You have an incredible longtime director. Russell was here for 33 years, and I have nothing but respect for what he accomplished while he was here, right? The entire institution is actually sort of molded around one director, right? Because he was here for so long. That's inevitable. So there's a lot of change management that's going on right now. I was very clear when I was getting interviewed, when I was asked, do you have a vision? A personal vision for the Chazen, that actually I reject that premise, right? It is not my job to come in as someone who has spent a very small fraction of my time here at the museum and just say, this is the vision. I'm going to put myself on top of it, you know, on top of this institution and change it to this. It's actually my job to set up a process by which we can think about what we need to be, right? Vanguard of university art museums in the 21st century, and realize together what that vision is actually going to look like. It will be richer and deeper, and we will get more investment, not only from the Chazen staff, but from the university and hopefully from the community, if we are more inclusive about the process to get there.
Amy, when you find yourself faced with these tasks, is there a work of art or anything that you go to that sort of quiets the mind? Do you have a favorite piece? Mine is always the Kavner Elamante. Mm. Like, that's where, when I'm having a hard time and I need to figure something out, yeah, it's one of the places where I can just sort of go and collect myself. Mm-hmm. Is there a work of art or an object or anything that does that for you?
So I like that you've asked the question in that way, because that implies, as you said, as we were walking up here, that you have long-term friendships with these objects, right? You have relationships. Maybe friendship is a little bit too specific. And I am still developing my relationships with the objects here. So while there are some places like the bridge here that we're standing on that I return to again and again, what I have started doing since I have been here is when I need a break, right? When I need to think, when I need to gather my thoughts, I kind of just let myself come out of my office and come upstairs and wander a little bit, because I will almost always end up looking at an object I hadn't looked at before, because so much of it is new to me. And even though I've spent now a lot of time in the galleries, is everything, you know, I'm continuing to discover. So I'll find myself, right, in a different corner of the museum, or up on the fourth floor in the Elvium building, or, in front of any particular piece. And I am discovering as I go, right, the things that strike me, the things that struck me originally that I now, like, look at differently. So I feel like I'm actually developing the relationship with the collection and the building and sort of like, you know, the space in which it's housed. So it's not so much that it's like a break from, you know, whatever is going on in my head. It's that exploring the collection in this way. And I don't try to run through the whole museum every week or anything like that. I just take a little corner, right? Spend some time with an object or three objects or a gallery or something like that. It helps remind me what it is I'm trying to do here. It kind of brings me back to center, right? I have my little chasen moment, if you will, and then I can go on with the rest of my day.
There's one thing I always say about a museum when I'm in it. I don't care if it's one that I've been coming to since the 80s or a new museum. I always tend to, sometimes I don't even know what I'm looking at or where I'm going, but I always seem to end up where I'm supposed to be.
I love that you've described it that way, because really, that's a much more succinct way of saying what I just took 5 minutes to describe, right? My little wandering is that I usually end up in front of an object or two or in a gallery where I'm suddenly struck that how stunning that the things that are going on in this gallery are related to the problem that I am trying to solve in my head. How did that happen? Well, of course, your mind works in kind of amazing ways, right? And I think that actually, I want to encourage more people to have that kind of relationship with the museum, not just to get someone to come here when we have an event or because they're interested in a single exhibition, but also, do you want to come here and just walk in the museum? It's free, and then walk upstairs and be here for 15 minutes. You don't have to come to the museum for hours, right? It's like there's no time requirement to have a deep and engaging experience. Just go look at one object, right? Just go take, and in fact, I would suggest that the more you try to pack it in, the less of a sort of deeper engagement you will have overall, right? That may be a great way to see a museum in a city that you're only going to spend a very short amount of time in as a very, very high level but not very deep kind of view. But if you really want to, if you live here, or if you live near here, or if you're going to be coming to Madison periodically, or if you're a student here for 4 years or 8 years or however long you're here, you develop the relationship with the museum not by coming here for an event. You develop the relationship because you decide that, oh, I'm walking by here and I have 20 minutes before my class. And I think I'm gonna go in and sit in that little niche where we have the chairs where you can look outside and you can see the objects. Like, that's a great space. And that is the kind of space that I want us to create more opportunities to have those kinds of experiences.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts. In this edition, she introduced us to Dr. Amy Gilman, the new director of the Chazen Museum in Madison.
We'll take one more break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal story.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time once again for Exfabula Radio on WUWM's Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bruce Winter, and this week we welcome Exfabula's Desiree Constantino to the studio. Leah is on vacation. Hey, Des, how's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty darn good. This week's theme is all about volunteerism, and you began at Exfabula as a volunteer.
I did. I Well, I told one story, and after that I thought, you know, this place is pretty amazing, so how do I get more involved? And from the information table, I kind of worked my way up, and now I do the stories on the weekends.
Yeah, basically you are the curator of stories, right?
I am. I do the background work. Lee is the voice, and I'm the background girl.
Well, this week you get the glory.
This week I get to be the voice.
So why is volunteerism the theme this week?
Well, we do have a volunteer orientation coming up next week, and it'll be the last volunteer orientation of 2017, if you can believe that. Mm. And so, you know, we wanted to kind of highlight stories that our volunteers have told on stage, because some of our volunteers only like to work on the ground. But a lot of our volunteers started out, as I did, by telling a story first and then going on to really catch the bug. Mm-hmm. That is Xfabula.
All right. So our first storyteller today is a volunteer.
She is. Jacqueline Rice has worked both at events and also doing background work for us as well. And she comes to us from the Do the Math story slam in April of 2015.
I don't want to be a boss, but there's a few numbers to pay attention to in my story. Third, fourth, the number 9, and the number 17. You don't have to, you don't want to, but I just, heads up. One morning I woke to the sound of singing. It was the kind of singing that when you hear it, especially when you're in a sleepy state, it sort of grabs a hold of you and involves your body as well. And it was a woman singing and a man joining in, and their voices intertwining, and I said, what the hell is that? Who is that? And I soon woke up. I didn't want to because I was having a very nice time listening, and I learned that they were interviewing Maury Yeston, who's a composer and lyricist, and they were reviving the musical 9, and it was starring Antonio Banderas, and I said, I will see that play. And so I went immediately to the internet and found out everything I needed to know, which was they were going to get more tickets, they were going to release them, they were extending the date. I said, I'm getting some. I went on the computer every day for about 10 days. And on June 11th, 2003, I had third row center seats staring at me from my computer. I couldn't believe it. I said, they're third row center seats. So the only problem was my sister was flying to Los Angeles at that moment, and she was going to go with me. I looked at them about 10 more times, clicked submit, and I said, I'll deal with Leslie later. So I called her and I said, can you go on September 24th to see 9 in New York? And she said, did she say third row center? And I said, yeah. And she said, I can work with that. Don't you just love my sister? So I had a whole summer to get through. But luckily it was summer, and it was in Milwaukee, and it goes fairly fast. So pretty soon, besides counting down the days and months, I was counting down, the months, the weeks, the days, and then finally, 24 hours. I was on a flight, 24 hours before, I was on a flight to New York. Then I was counting down the hours, 18, 12, 10, 9, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I was walking down West 47th Street into the Eugene O'Neill Theater, and halfway, and I saw my third row center seat, and it's like, I'm waiting, get in here, sit down. I got in, I sat down, and I waited. Not very long. Antonio Banderas came on stage, and he, I don't know if you're a fan, if you're not, he can sing, he can dance, he can act. And he did all of that and was so amazing, and I literally was transfixed the entire time. Second act comes. It starts with the song that I had heard on the radio called Unusual Way. It was a duet. I think you probably knew that. And it goes from there. The 9 was involved the 9 women in his life from the Fellini's 8 and a half. But by the end of the story, the play, he's lost everything. And he's on his own, and he's on the stage, and I can see the sweat, and I can see the passion, and the pain, and the sexiness, and everything. And so I was leaning forward in my seat, like, my heart was pounding. He was singing about how he was on his own, and what would he do? And I was... I can't even explain it. I was so transfixed. My heart was pounding. I felt like I was ill, but in a good way. And then it came to an end. And it had been a beautiful, wonderful experience, one of the best experiences of my life. And, you know, experiences are what it's all about. And I got up and I thought, oh my God, I have to call my mom. She is going to just be so amazed. And a split second later, I remembered that my mom was dead. In fact, she had died 17 years earlier. But because I had been so in the moment, which is where you're supposed to be, for that brief amount of time, I had gone to the fourth dimension time, and to that place where my mother was still alive and well.
And that was Jacqueline Rice from April of 2015.
I have been to a lot of concerts in my time, but I have never been so moved that I was transformed to another time.
I know. And thinking about Antonio Banderas, that took me to another to another time and place as well.
Indeed. Our theme this week on Ex Fabulo Radio is volunteerism, and we're listening to stories from some of Ex Fabulo's volunteers that they have told over the years. And in addition to the volunteer workshop that's coming up, you guys just had the big event this Friday at the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center, big stage. But other events are coming up real soon, right?
Well, we do have on December 5th, this year is the 50th anniversary of the housing marches in Milwaukee.
Yes.
And so Ex Fabula has been collaborating. Our fellowship this year is all about race and place. And on December 5th, we have a secret Fabula event, and it's the Milwaukee Housing Marches through the UWM archives. And our secret Fabula events are specific member events. There will be a handful of tickets available for purchase for people that are not Ex Fabula members.
Should I become one?
Well, that's the best way to do it, yes.
And that's information on that is at exfabula.org.
Yes.
And okay, second story for today.
We have Nelson Lopez. Nelson Lopez is one of our storytelling workshop coaches, as well as one of our events volunteers. And he comes to us from our Fatherhood Story Slam in February of 2016.
My dad, I really never had a dad, but he told me that I was his kid number 99. I thought, and he was like, yay? So according, in his mind, he had 99 kids. And he never liked any of them. He got married once. His wife, actually, his first wife, this year turns 100. And she's still alive. He died when I was 9. But we have... Now, through Facebook, I've met a lot of my brothers and sisters. And when my father died, I met a lot of them. And I didn't know I had so many brothers and sisters. You know, I thought he was joking when he said that he had 99 kids. And fortunately or unfortunately, I am the number 99. I'm that magical number. And every single kid has a different story. He never lived with us, with my brother and me. He never lived with us, and I'm grateful for that. He had, with one family, he had 5 kids, and he gave 3 names to every kid. He was into Russian literature at the time, and he gave Russian names to every kid. So, and he was always drunk, and when I tell the story of my father, is he. He never, never, never had one friend. Never. And yet he had 99 kids. So somebody told me he was busy making love. But my father was one of those people who would come to his house, whoever family he was living with, and he wouldn't talk to anybody. He would just come, and it was 3 p.m., and he would tell people, all right, everybody, go to sleep. It was 3 p.m. I said, go to sleep, everybody. And everybody had to go to sleep. Otherwise, you know, in his craziness, he will just react, get angry, and do crazy stuff. One of my brothers that I met a few years ago, he lives in Texas. He said that when he was 20, he decided that he was going to kill my father. And he got a gun. And he was waiting for my dad. And when my dad came home, he said, okay, I'm ready. Now you're going to die today. And my father, you know, didn't really talk much. He said, what, you are going to kill me? You are not man enough to kill me. And my brother was 20, and he was shaking. And he decided he was going to end my dad's life that day. You know how much torment he had through his 20 years. And he was ready, and he was going to do it. He said, you don't have the balls to do it. You won't do it. And he pulled the trigger, and the gun didn't go. And my dad was laughing at him. He said, see, I told you, right? You wouldn't do it. You couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. And my brother said that at that moment, he had to leave the house. And I am from El Salvador originally, and he left. He came to the United States by himself. And now I have, my oldest daughter is 9, and I'm trying to do everything completely different. What my father did to his children and what he did to me, I'm trying to do everything that is very different. My daughter, she can say anything. I always tell her the truth, and she knows that I'm not going to lie to her. When she asked me about Santa Claus, I got a phone call from the school that she had told every kid that Santa Claus was not real. And the teacher said, was that necessary? But that's one of the things that I want, because I was always silenced as a kid. I was always, my laughter was always repressed. And one of the things that I wanted her to do was to live her life to the fullest. Thank you.
And that was Nelson Lopez from our February 2016 event, Fatherhood. And just as a reminder, we do have our volunteer orientation, the last one of 2017, and that'll be on Tuesday, November 21st. And also coming up after the holiday, we have our December 5th Secret Fabula event, and that'll be the Milwaukee Housing Marches through the UWM Archives. All of this and more is available at xfabula.org.
And if you want to listen to these stories again or share them, they are at WUWM.com. Desiree Constantino pitching for Leah Delaney this week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
X Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend.
How numb can words remain? How numb can feelings fall? When beloved is amused, no man can escape.
It had been a few years since the last new album from Milwaukee musician Mike Mangione. He'd been busy helping raise 3 kids and producing his occasional podcast, Time and the Mystery. Also, he was playing gigs around the world.
But his new album, recorded with his brother Tom and Sista Strings, Monique and Shantae Ross, got its official launch on Friday with a concert at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. The album is called But I've Seen the Stars. Mike Mangione and the Kin joined us in the Lake Effect Performance Studio as well and offered up a few tunes, including this one called Nothing Lasts Forever.
And if you want me, babe, please want me here today. Because nothing lasts forever and nothing's here to stay. So many seem the mornings, now one less until I go. But no beauty of a sunrise could can fulfill that hate that we almost know. And though I acted foolish, I was a thief among family. But no fault to bleach, desire can redeem eternity. And I know so well forgiveness, I know so well regret. Every time they pierce my heart, well, it feels like they've never met. If you want me, babe, please want me here today. Because nothing lasts forever, nothing's here to stay. Want me, babe? Please want me here today. Because nothing lasts forever, nothing's here to stay. If you want me, baby, step out and take my hand.
Mike Mangione and The Kin playing Nothing Lasts Forever in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. It's from their new album, But I've Seen the Stars.
And sad to say, Lake Effect Weekend doesn't last forever, just until 4 o'clock, which means it is time to wrap up another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Oh, 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 oh,
stay tuned. All the latest news is next on All Things Considered. It is 4 o'clock.